Call your first case.
May it please the court, Sandra Rowland on behalf of Gregory Terrell. Unless the court would prefer differently, I will begin with the second issue in our brief. If the court remands on this issue, it would not necessarily need to reach the ex post facto issue. The district court's approach to sentencing Mr. Terrell was flawed in several respects. One of the procedural flaws was that the judge used the wrong framework. He asked the wrong question when he asked what would be a reasonable sentence instead of asking what he's mandated to ask under 3553, which is what is the sufficient but not greater than necessary sentence.
Can we not assume that a judge who referred to reasonable means reasonable within the terms of existing law? Do they have to, every time they enter a sentence, recite the entire 3553 form?
Absolutely not. And we do not.
All right. Absolutely not what?
Absolutely not.
We cannot assume that a judge knows the law?
No, I'm sorry. I was agreeing with the court.
Okay.
A judge, we do not claim that the judge failed to consider the 3553 factors here. And I don't contend that uttering the word reasonable means that the judge use the wrong standard. At the risk of boring the court, I would like to point out some citations, because I think when you read the record as a whole, it becomes very clear that the judge was using the wrong standard.
Can I just get the framework of this down? This is a claim of plain error.
Yes.
So the
every issue,
relevant law is the law at the time of the sentencing.
Yes. At the time of this sentencing, this court had decided Pickett and Dorsley, in which they stated the correct standard, that the reasonable standard was an appellate standard, and that the district court judges were not to use that standard. They were to seek out the sufficient but not greater than necessary sentence. So it was plain at the time of the sentencing. I would ask the court to look at the transcripts on August 4th, 2005, at pages 17, 18, 20, 29, and 31, on June 27, 2006, at pages 4 and 9, and March 27, 2007, at page 9. We would not be here complaining if the judge said, I want to impose a fair and reasonable sentence, but he explained to Mr. Terrell over and over again his job, and he explained it again and again, that my job is to determine what a reasonable sentence is. It's a very unusual.
I'm sorry, the end of your sentence.
My job is to determine what a reasonable sentence is. That is a direct quote. It's a very unusual case because the district court actually found on the facts before him that a below guideline sentence, 188 months, was just as serious a penalty here as the low end of the guideline, which was 210 months. In the context of asking the prosecutor to grant the third point for acceptance of responsibility, the judge said, I'm asking the government to move for the third point, recognizing that 188 months is just as serious as 210 months. I mean, there's a numerical difference, but in the scheme of things in the real world, that's not a heck of a lot of difference. So 210 months, the bottom of the guideline range, might have been a reasonable sentence, and certainly this court reviewing it would say anything from 210 to 262 was presumptively reasonable. But 188 months was sufficient, and that is what the statute promises Mr. Terrell, a sentence that's sufficient but not greater than necessary.
How do you distinguish U.S. versus Anderson, which there the trial judge apparently required special evidentiary justification to deviate from the guideline sentence. And we said that that would have been plain error if it had been decided after Rita, but since it was decided in that case 2 years before Rita, it was not.
That is one of the errors that we allege. We allege three errors with respect to the judge's approach to sentencing. One is that he required extraordinary circumstances in order to depart.
No, but I mean, the defendant lost in that case because of the timing issue.
Yes. I guess I'm just trying to point out that with respect to what I was just, that there are three procedural errors, but and that goes to one of them, but not this
you're
one.
You're not focusing on the question that I'm raising.
Okay.
So far as I can make out, the timing issue for Mr. Terrell is just as problematic as it was for Anderson. That is to say, we have a judge doing this, and we have the judge doing it before Rita, and in Anderson, we said it was not plain error because it was not clear at the time.
Here, the judge was doing the thing I just described after this court's decisions in Pickett and Dorsley.
What are the Pickett and Dorsley? See from your brief, Pickett is 2007, which is afterwards, right? Because we're talking about a 2005 sentencing here.
No, he was actually sentenced in 2007.
2007, okay, yes. So it's a matter of days.
Yes, right? And so the decision in Pickett said...
It's the dates that I need.
Oh, okay.
I'll assume you're right in characterizing Pickett.
Okay. Pickett was decided February 13th, 2007, and Mr. Terrell was sentenced on April 24th, 2007. With regard to the ex post facto clause issue, there is nothing that prevents the court from addressing the merits of this issue. The plea.
What about the plea agreement?
The plea agreement did not contain an appellate waiver. The government cites cases and discusses appellate waivers and cites to the page of the transcript of the guilty plea hearing where the judge explained, as judges always do, that when you give up your constitutional right to a trial, there's nothing left to appeal except the sentence. He did not suggest that there was no appellate waiver whatsoever.
What do you understand paragraph 11 of the plea agreement to be saying? Is it he's saying he's not going to challenge the sentencing, right? Wasn't that? Your client agrees not to seek any decreases in your client's base offense level.
Mm-hmm. And my client didn't. The district court brought up this issue sua sponte.
Isn't your client seeking one now?
No. What I'm seeking now is the district court's correct calculation of the guidelines. The district court brought up the issue.
Will that have it if you prevail? Will that have an effect on the base offense level?
It will.
You're asking
on the final offense level. Yes, it would reduce it by 1 point.
Is that different than the base offense level?
Well, maybe not. I consider the base to be the one you start with, and
right,
then you
that
add
was 30.
Adjustments.
Okay.
And,
okay.
So yes, it would change his guideline range.
What I'm getting at is he's agreed not to seek any decrease in the base offense level.
Correct.
How does that apply to your appeal?
Okay. Below, he did not seek any decrease. The court brought it up sua sponte, and he didn't even speak to it.
Right.
The court was misinformed by the prosecutor and the probation officer. Now, what we are seeking is the court's correct calculation of the guidelines. When a judge, both parties were aware that their calculation of the guidelines would not control, that the court would make its own calculation, and it could be very different, and that is included in every plea agreement, and certainly the government knows that. It often happens that the probation office or the court sees an adjustment that the parties hadn't noticed, and usually it's to the detriment of the defendant. Here, it would have been to the benefit of the defendant. And having noticed that, having brought that up, Mr. Terrell is now entitled to a correct guideline calculation.
Even though he agreed that he would not challenge the determination of the base offense level. It seems to me the only way you get out from under that is to say this wasn't he's not challenging the base offense level, he's challenging something.
He's challenging a district court error of law.
And he agreed that there were certain things that he wasn't going to challenge. Okay, can I go back to the ex post facto? I have a question. Why doesn't the plain error analysis take care of it? At the time that the sentencing was done, we hadn't yet decided whether there were ex post facto issues raised by using the 2005 guidelines. There were cases at the time. Turner hadn't yet been decided yet, and Andrews said at the time, this is, the plain error analysis protects the court here because it's not yet decided. It wasn't clear.
I don't think that what is required is for this court or the Supreme Court to rule on every single guideline subsection.
But in Andrews, we said on this, we said it's not yet resolved. This issue isn't yet resolved. It didn't get resolved till Turner, right?
I think that the issue is resolved by 1B1.1, which says apply the guideline that.
But that was advisory as well, right?
That is most favorable. Well,
in the wake of Booker, everything was unclear for a while. Why wasn't this unclear at the time?
I don't think it was ever unclear that you had to correctly calculate the guidelines. That was unclear.
That's not the point. The point is, what effect do the 2005 guidelines have?
The 2005 guidelines substantially changed.
You're saying it was plain error not to use the 2002 guidelines.
Yes,
right?
Part of the.
And if you use the 2005 guidelines, that was plain error. I'm saying at the time of the sentencing, it wasn't clear what the relationship was between the two as regards to ex post facto violations.
It was clear that two things had changed, that the decision maker had changed and the terms had changed. Now you had to prove that you were timely in your plea and that you help the government in, you were forthcoming with information about your offense. Previously, you only had to show that you were forthcoming about your offense. So I don't think that a district court needs a ruling from this court to say, we're calculating the guidelines and this 2002 turns out to be better for the defendant. There are a lot of guidelines, and I don't think that they need a ruling on, 3E1.3B before they can say it's an ex post facto guideline. You look at the two guidelines, and it's plain on the face. And the guidelines instruct the courts to do that very thing, that really the first thing you need to do is figure out which manual you're using. The one at the time of the offense or the one at the time of sentencing.
You raised timely. How was your client's assistance timely here? It was on the eve of trial.
We don't really...
I mean, if we were to remand, don't you lose on the merits on that one?
I don't know, because I don't know what all the factors were. I think that the district court would have to inquire, you know, what was the delay here? Was it produced by the lawyer? He did have three different lawyers. Was it the lawyers? Was it the... there are factors that he would have to consider that are not in the record.
Your time is up, unless my colleagues have further questions. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if needed.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. If I may just turn to the ex post facto issue first. This, first of all, is barred by his plea agreement in paragraph 11.
He's not challenging the base offense level. Base offense level was 30. He's challenging whether...
The adjustment.
That's not the base offense level, right?
That's correct.
The pre-sentence report tells us what the base offense level is, and it's 30.
He's not
challenging that.
No, he's not challenging...
So how does paragraph 11 have anything to do with...
Well, because as paragraph 11 reads, it's your client agrees that the base offense level should be decreased by two levels based upon your client's acceptance of responsibility. Your client agrees not to seek any decreases in your client's base offense level other than those which are agreed to by the government within this paragraph. So they may have used the term base offense level inartfully, but it's clear from the context of the paragraph that they're talking about acceptance of responsibility credits here.
If we are imposing a waiver of constitutional rights, should we not be rather strict in our application of the language of the agreement?
Well, we should be strict about it, but if you look at the language and what the language is really talking about there is that although it uses the term base offense level, they're talking about the fact that you're not going to ask for any
further decreases. That's what it says, and is that what's going on here? Did he ever violate that language? Assume just that language. Did he ever violate that?
The base offense level? No, not the base offense level. If we're looking at that, as
paragraph 11 really doesn't bar this, does it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Paragraph 11 doesn't really bar this, then, does it?
Well, we believe it does because what they're truly talking about there is acceptance of responsibility credits, and by filing this appeal, they are seeking ultimately more acceptance of responsibility credits. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I wonder why you didn't say that then, if that's what you were talking about. I mean, your side was a party to this agreement; they could have. If that's what you meant, you could have said so, couldn't you?
We could have, and it
would have been a nice thing to have done, wouldn't it?
Well, even moving on from that, even if the court finds that it's not barred, there's simply no plain error here. There's no ex post facto violation, because what you're doing is you're looking at the specific guideline, in this case 3E1.1, and asking, did that guideline, in effect at the time of sentencing, create a substantial risk that this defendant's sentence was more severe than it would have been under a guideline at the time of the offense? And here, that's simply not the case. Either in the 2002 version or the 2005 version used here, the notes say that, in general, the conduct qualifying for a decrease in the offense level under subsection B is going to occur particularly early in the case. And as we cited in our brief, there's a lot of case law that supports that an eve of trial plea simply doesn't fulfill that guideline requirement. So what you have here is if you faithfully apply the guideline as it's supposed to be applied, you're not going to get a third point for acceptance of responsibility, given that this particular defendant pled guilty on August 4th. He had a trial date scheduled for August 2nd and then another trial date scheduled on August 5th. That is beyond eve of trial. It's 2 days after trial.
I thought you're on the ex post facto argument. You've now shifted to more of a merits argument, right? You're saying even if we remanded, it wasn't a time.
I tried to twist her into it.
Okay.
Well, yeah, and it's all of those things. If you remand, it's really remanding to give the defendant a windfall of the district court not putting a faithful application of 3E1.1B on the books. He's really not entitled under the new guideline or the old version of the guideline. So on remand, it would really be an abuse of discretion for the court, for the district court to give him that extra point under a faithful reading of the guideline.
Can I nudge you to the ex post facto?
Sure. Working backwards.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Working backwards to that, because of those reasons, because this defendant's sentence shouldn't and wouldn't be more severe than it would have been under the old guidelines. That means there's no ex post facto error, and it also means under plain error analysis that he wasn't prejudiced by the application of the new versus the old guideline. And also for those same reasons, he can't show that the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial process.
So help me with this, and maybe this isn't developed enough. I thought there was a more basic argument, and that is that in Andrews we said it's not clear. The ex post facto issue isn't yet clear.
It wasn't clear until Turner, right? I believe in Andrews they were questioning whether or not Booker had created some question about ex post facto, and that was unclear. I believe that's cleared up, and that Booker doesn't.
Yeah, and Turner later, a couple months after.
Turner and Andrews were actually co-defendants. Yeah. And the real difference between them is Andrews was under a plain error analysis.
Page 909 of Andrews, this circuit has not yet determined whether after Booker, application of a later than the date of offense guidelines manual that yields a higher sentence continues to raise an ex post facto problem.
That's correct. Under Andrews, and also if you even want to look at the guideline that's at issue here, 3E1.1B, this court and the Supreme Court have never said that using a later post-amendment guideline creates an ex post facto violation. So if you're looking at whether the error is plain or obvious, if there even is one in this case, it's not plain or obvious under these circumstances. Particularly in a situation where this defendant, if you look at the merits of the guideline, wouldn't be entitled. He entered the plea very late after voir dire was filed, as the government stated, when the court asked him to move for the third point. So for all of those reasons, we don't believe that under plain error analysis there was any sort of ex post facto violation here. Turning to whether or not the court otherwise committed procedural error in sentencing the defendant, again, that's under a plain error review. The court did exactly what was later required in Gall, and notably Gall wasn't in place at the time of the sentencing, but the court did everything procedural that was required. It considered the guidelines as a starting point. It calculated the guidelines range and did so correctly. It considered 3553A factors, as appellant has conceded here this morning. It selected a sentence based on the individual facts relevant to this individual, and it explained its sentence on the record.
Really regarded deviation from the guidelines as requiring something really special.
I don't.
And this court in Pickett had already said that was not correct.
The court had said in Pickett that the district court has to evaluate how well the guidelines affect the purpose of sentencing enumerated in 3553A, and we believe the court was well aware of that because it had actually held up sentencing awaiting the Pickett decision and had taken Pickett into consideration, clearly, because it was trying to figure out whether Pickett would work any change to this particular defendant's sentence, given that in regard to the crack powder ratio. And given that the court was well aware of Pickett, as it had said at numerous status conferences, and everybody had ultimately agreed at the time of sentencing that Pickett didn't help here, it certainly indicates the court knew that it couldn't presume a within-guideline sentence to be correct. And as the court has said in Pinnock, you're assuming that the judge knows the law, and you're not required to specifically go through every 3553A factor. The court numerous times also recognized that in language stating that the guidelines were voluntary, they were advisory, they weren't mandatory. And in this fact, the court even postponed sentencing for a month to allow defense counsel to find further facts about his client that might warrant a below guidelines sentence in this case. But ultimately, at sentencing in the end of April 2007, the court didn't use compelling language, and it just ruled properly that the defendant appeared to fit the profile of a career offender, that the court was at a loss to find any 3553A factors that would make it more appropriate to sentence him below the guidelines range, and particularly the defendant had a significant criminal history. Given the facts of the case the court was sentencing on, the defendant didn't appear to be a low-end drug dealer. He didn't appear to be undertaking the offense due to drug addiction or so forth. And for those reasons, the court decided that ultimately a within-guideline sentence at the low end of the range was appropriate. So when push came to shove and you were at the sentencing hearing, the court did exactly what it was supposed to do, regardless of whether it had used the term compelling at other times, such as at the plea hearing or at a status hearing over a year, almost a year before the ultimate sentencing occurred. And ultimately, the court did what it was supposed to do procedurally in this case, and it certainly didn't do anything that would rise to the level of plain error here, particularly since Gall and Rita had not been decided at that time. And for all those reasons, if the court has no further questions, we respectfully request that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You wish rebuttal? Award 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
With regard to the 2002 guidelines on acceptance of responsibility, I would note that application note 6 directs the district court to look at the timeliness of defendant's acceptance of responsibility is a consideration and is context specific, and we really don't have the information here that the court would need to be able to say that he was not eligible for it. Regarding the district court's sua sponte attempt to adjust the offense level, in our reply brief at page 4, we cite cases for the proposition that a plea agreement between the parties is not breached where district court sua sponte applies an adjustment or a departure not contemplated by the parties. I think that if you, when you read the whole record, and there were many, many hearings, I mean, nothing happened quickly in this case, the offense was 10 years ago, you really get the picture of a district court who wanted very much to find a way to reduce the guideline range. He did everything he could. He kept postponing, even when the lawyer would say, I don't think Pickett helps me, he would postpone because he wanted to reduce the guideline range. He thought he needed to sentence within the guideline range, and he didn't want to slam Mr. Terrell. In the end, he couldn't find a way to reduce the range because he had misinformation about acceptance responsibility, and so he sentenced Mr. Terrell at the bottom of the guideline range. We asked the court to remand to the district court for resentencing.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.